You're listening to Data Center Therapy. Please take a number, and an engineer will be right with you.
Welcome back to Data Center Therapy, Ivoxy Consulting's Data Center Derived Podcast. I am Matt Yeti. I am here with Mac Nethkin. Mac is our network specialist, but I will let Mac kind of intro himself a little bit because it's really interesting where he's come from. Mac, tell me a little bit about yourself professionally, personally.
I've been a network engineer since the mid-90s. Started doing building computers myself and then installing small networks for like medical dental offices and so forth. And then as the explosion of the internet, I ended up working at Alaska Airlines for almost 10 years, helping them build their data center and doing a lot of cool stuff with disaster recovery and AlaskaAir.com and whatnot. After that, I moved to the Cobalt Group, not the one that makes tools. These were automotive digital marketing. We had 10,000 domains we were hosted, which was about half of all the automotive dealerships in the United States used Cobalt for their web presence. So that was pretty good. It was a large data center, a lot of throughput, a lot of growth on stuff, a lot of security. That was right at the era when security started becoming really important with intrusion prevention systems and whatnot. I ended up in the VAR space. I've been working for a value-added reseller. Ivoxy, obviously, is where I'm at today. I've also worked for INX and Denali, where I'd go out and help customers, you know, identify requirements, identify pain points, problems, and, you know, come up with architecture and design recommendations and help them upgrade their network, get from where they're at to where they need to be.
Yeah, so, and it's important you brought it up where at Ivoxy we kind of have two practices that do have some semblance of overlap. Of course, we have our systems, which is both mostly, you know, data center application backend, so storage and compute and disaster recovery, data protection, and then we have our networking practice, which Mac heads up. So we're talking anywhere from top of rack or closet campus layout layer two to static routing, dynamic VPN, MPLS.
We cover the I call it big four: routing, switching, security, and wireless. That spans from data center to campus, branch office connectivity. We also do wide area network stuff with MPLS and SD-WAN and so forth, just how to connect the endpoints to the servers.
And one of your big four is basically the big one in both of our realms right now, which is security.
Correct.
And that's kind of what we want to talk about today is essentially malware and how you protect your infrastructure against it, how you react to, without being fuddy, right? Good old fear, uncertainty, and doubt. How you react when something happens? Because at this point, it's almost a matter of when. And we're not trying to scare you into that. We've seen out in the field with our customers and the Fortune 50, Fortune 500 companies. You are not immune, big or small, unfortunately.
Correct.
With automated script kiddies, script based tools, it doesn't discriminate. If you are on the internet. If you have an email address, you potentially are a target, whether it's targeted or just automated, you know, sweeping. So we just saw one very recently, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The FUD you had to talk about, fear, uncertainty, doubt, is really important because it's, there's a lot of customers I interface with and I get real feedback from them of what they experience. You know, I mean, I remember years and years ago, you had like the Michelangelo virus, mm-hmm. which would make like the 5 o'clock news. And then it was all about advertisement and so forth, that kind of stuff. Today, the crooks have monetized it. Yeah. They're out for money.
There's an incentive outside of destruction.
There's a huge amount of money out for it. They're using Bitcoin to pay the ransom. So we hear ransomware. And I've had many customers, you know, come to me and say, yeah, you know, we've had two workstations hit with ransomware in the last, you know, 6 months, whatever. Sometimes they pay the ransom and get the key. Sometimes they don't. I actually had a really large incident that, you know, talking about the fear, uncertainty, doubt, that actually was fearful for myself when I ran into it, was the ransomware actually encrypted the servers. It was able to compromise the domain admin account for a company and encrypted the servers. That shut down their company.
That's everything.
It turned into a DR event. Yeah. And you know, when we think DR, we usually think volcanoes, hurricanes, tornadoes, flooding, extended power outages.
A geo issue.
Right. imagine if your critical servers, the data got encrypted, your SQL databases all broke, and you could no longer service your customers, mm-hmm. right? You're into, I need to roll this data back, you know, to a point that didn't have the malware. And the interesting thing with malware is it's actually designed to stick around for a while. It's not like, you catch a bug and it happens instantly. You know, in all of these cases of the ransomware and malware stuff, it's been in the customer's environment for months. That's how it collects all the data.
Mm-hmm. And the danger in that is, when something like that strikes, your first instinct is, we have to get back up and online, which is obviously priority one, but how do you protect yourself from it happening again if you're not able to investigate and interrogate how it happened in the first place? And when something's low, lying, slow crawling, and takes time to build up and collect all that data, how do you investigate that intrusion 4 months ago is where this started?
You wouldn't even know it happened 4 months ago.
Right.
You may say, oh, well, everything was working fine Tuesday. Wednesday, I came into work and it was broke. So you roll back to, I don't know, say Mondays. Well, Monday, you're just a day away from when it's gonna attack mm-hmm. again, right? So you have to be able to identify where the malware came in, so you can go back to a point in time to eradicate it, to prevent it from doing its damage.
So it sounds like there's two parts. One is hardening your environment, following best practices, and making it difficult for the infection to happen in the first place. But then it sounds like getting some proper logging or environment monitoring in the right places is just as important.
Well, first off, it's an enormous to-do list with an infinite amount of products out there to put together. So, thing with security, if anybody comes to you and says, hey, buy my product, you'll be 100% secure, they're lying to you. Nothing is 100% secure, right? Security is best made up of layers, and it's also best looked at holistically, right? So I deal primarily with network security. So I'm looking at routers and switches and firewalls, you know, and best practice about how you manage that stuff. Obviously, with the firewalls comes intrusion prevention, you know, URL filtering, anti-malware, you know, at the edge and so forth. But you also have things such as, you know, encrypting your data, data loss prevention, email filtering, and that kind of stuff, which goes outside of even what the normal network security is. So it's important to understand that really in security, I look at it as there's two different parts to it, right? The network security, which looks at the transmission between the endpoint and the servers, but then you also have like endpoint security that would go on both the servers and on the workstations and so forth. And that's something interesting today because most everybody is mobile, right? Our borders have disappeared.
Right.
You know, people have a laptop at work, they take it home. So it's at Starbucks, it's at their house. It's, you know, so even if you have the best firewall with the best intrusion prevention, people are going to bring it in around the firewall mm-hmm. when they come in to work for the day.
Yeah. And one thing that we also see out there is even if you have a backup of your data, it must be immutable, right? We've seen backup copies of data become encrypted and there. So you think you're set. You think you've checked that box. I have another copy of my data. It may be offsite, but if it's part of the domain or not immutable, boom, that's locked as well.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, like you were talking about multiple attack vectors, right? It used to be north-south, right? You've got a firewall. You're all good because everybody's got a workstation that's plugged into the network. And not that that's secure by default, but the mobility of it has really created a lot more variables. So one of those, you know, still the firewall is not that it's not important anymore, but it's only one piece of your protection. But let's look at the firewall and say, okay, I know my, you know, my ASA, my Cisco ASA, you know, it's a staple in the firewall world. But now I'm hearing about next generation firewalls. So Am I good with an ASA still, or should I be looking at this layer 7 stuff?
Right. So the buzzword next gen firewall technically means let's look at the firewall rules based on the actual application. Like a great example is SSH. SSH runs on port 22, mm-hmm. right? What if somebody puts a firewall and says we're going to block port 22 outbound? That way, we don't want any of our users through SSH to go out to the internet. So somebody sets up an SSH daemon at home running on port 80,
mm-hmm.
right? Now all of a sudden they can SSH out, they've gotten around your firewall rules. Next-gen firewall rules would say block SSH, I don't care what port it's on, right? So that's where we're at today on firewall securities, which is where everybody ought to be. The other thing is the firewalls of today typically can also hook into Active Directory, so you can say Joe is able to get to, you know, is able to SSH out, but Susie isn't, you know, for example.
Right. So from a holistic high level standpoint, from security points, we had firewalls that used to kind of, firewalls and antivirus used to be what everybody, that was how you handle it. Mm-hmm. What are the missing pieces that you think, and I'm not talking necessarily a specific product,
right,
but at what points am I talking? It probably starts with a security policy or a posture, right? I mean, that's not even a single product to install.
Correct.
But that needs to be met with.
Right. So first thing is we look at the users, right? Users is anybody that has an interface to a computer. So your IT admins are users. Obviously, you know, the receptionist, HR, they're all users of the infrastructure. We used to trust employees, right? Because they don't come to work with malicious intent, and we still don't believe they come to work with malicious intent. But we can't trust their workstations anymore, right? Because users invariably will click on a link that gets sent to them in email. You know, my wife used to work for Primera, and she was there when they had the breach. Mm. And that actually compromised both her and my social security number. We've both been hit with identity theft as a result of that. You know, I have a police report for 7 years, my credit report to lock it as a result of that breach.
Was that an email or a thumb drive?
That was an email came in.
Yeah.
I remember her telling, you know, talking about it. It was like a Friday. They got an email that said, "Hey, you're expect a package tomorrow morning. No notice or whatever." And it was an RSA token that they implemented two-factor authentication literally overnight to help curb that problem going forward. They also, I remember her telling me that at Primera, and this was going back a couple of years, that they would send out emails to users, their internal security team, and if you clicked the link, they were notified and you were fired. That was their thing. So they told the users, "You got training, don't click these links, and if you did, you lose your job," because the impact to Premier was huge over this. And they're not isolated. I mean, everybody's heard about the Target breach and you know, and so forth, the list of breaches going on. So as you said earlier, it's not a matter of if, it is a matter of when. Yeah. And, you know, I've got personal experience with at least four or five customers that I can think of that have been hit with ransomware, you know, over the last 2-3 years. It's a growing problem and the areas that you're looking at holistically, you know, so your attack vectors, you know, email, web, cloud, mobile, endpoints, campus branch, and your data center. You have to look at all of those and come up with a policy holistically. And it's not something that you're going to implement overnight either. It's more of, you know, look at what you've got today and look at all those attack vectors and say, okay, where are we most susceptible, and come up with budget and start a process to start implementing one thing after another. I mean, the example I always like to tell folks is, what if I took your laptop and I threw it in a safe deposit box at a bank? Pretty secure, but it's not very usable, right? You know, what if I gave you a laptop and I did no security on it and I put you out at Starbucks on an open internet, right? Well, now you're just waiting for something bad to happen to you as far as the attackers go. But they're all looking at Bitcoin, how they can send even an end user an email, click on a link, ransomware, send me $50, $100, $200, we'll give you the decryption key. I've heard of things where they'll target businesses and say, "Send me $80,000 or more, we'll give you the ransom key."
And when you think about the cost of business, it oftentimes can be cheaper to do that, which is just a scary proposition.
I think that's why they target the numbers of what they're looking for, because they're like, your downtime is way more money than what they're asking for.
Right.
But they're crooks, so there's no guarantee they'll give you the key.
That's very true. It's very true. It's tough because as a value-added reseller, and Ivoxy is very much emphasis on the value add, right? We're not product slingers. We don't just turn around product and then, you know, that's it. We're gone. Have fun. We like to be involved with building and designing the solution and implementing it and making sure that our customers are empowered to take advantage of that technology. But one of the tough things that we see is we can sell product and solutions till we're blue in the face for security, but ultimately your network is only as strong as your weakest user as well. And
correct,
we find that the education of the user base is really what can be your weak link. So it's something when we sit down with you and talk about your security posture, we want to be involved with, listen, how do we properly educate the user base? I used to work for a VAR in upstate New York when I lived back east, and we had a customer hire us for a security audit, like a pen test. And they had a website, and We found a login to their intranet on the website, which is not great practice in the first place, but okay. So I registered a domain, another .com that looked the same, but had a one instead of an L or mm-hmm. something. And then I scraped their website, basically put a duplicate of that login form on there, got their distribution list from somewhere on the website, an internal D-list, sent an email to the D-list saying, hey, we need you to validate your password. Mm-hmm. And sent them the link to my bogus site, which captured all the passwords in the clear, all the logins. And about 60% of the employees did it.
Right.
I mean, all it would take is one.
Right.
But, I mean, that's the kind of stuff where there was absolutely nothing in that factor, technically, that could have stopped that.
Right. That's social engineering. Was it Petraeus? John Petraeus, the secretary?
David?
With the Pentagon?
Yeah, that's him, David.
Yeah, he got caught with that.
Right.
Right, and that's how they got his password and compromised it, right? So that's the social engineering side of it, where it's really not even technology can stop that.
Right.
You know, because it looks legitimate, and then users click the links. It really comes down to user training.
Best practice says the users have proper rights, or rights that are narrow enough where, if anything, a subset of files are affected, right? Not a DA or something. Yeah.
And to talk about a specific product, in that case, for example, having a misspelled DNS domain name, right? You know, like you said, you do a one instead of an L, mm-hmm. for example, or, you know, you do three L's instead of two, you know, kind of stuff, where the eye doesn't technically pick that up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a product such as Cisco's Umbrella, which is basically a DNS filter. You know, used to be called OpenDNS. I think it still is for some things, but it's just a DNS in between. It's not authoritative for anything, but if you go and ask OpenDNS's name servers to resolve something, it's tied in to Talos and the security feature of Cisco that says, hey, wait a minute, we know that's a bogus domain, right. And it would stop the user from
going. Or it was just registered a month ago or something.
Right, it looks at a lot of that kind of stuff. And they say like over 90% of malware attacks, especially command and control stuff, can be stopped by looking at the DNS, right? Mm-hmm. By having a security product such as OpenDNS in the middle, that it's actually looking for where your users are going and that kind of stuff.
Well, back to that, the breach of the user accounts via social engineering, what I then did was log into the intranet and then started clicking around and noticed that there were some global variables passed in the URL. So it was, you know, I was handing off, you know, to a PHP page or an ASP page, variable equals this value. And I started to inject SQL commands. I started to escape those URLs.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what I got it to do? I got their SQL server to mirror their entire contents back to us. Not only so that was a vulnerability, but then I saw all the user accounts in their system, not only encrypted, but they had a column with it in clear text, all their mm-hmm. passwords in the database. So, I mean, how many layers of vulnerabilities are there?
Right, which is the exact reason why, just in general, you know, best practice for users, don't use the same password twice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's easy to have the one password. I use it for my banking. I use it for my, you know, for everything else I do. And then it's, you have no idea how one organization is saving that password. If you say reset my password and they send you an email back with what your password is, you know that password is being stored in clear text and it's unsecure.
Yep. Right? Even the two factor quote air quotes that leverage your phone number aren't safe anymore, because a thief steals your phone, gets your SIM,
mm-hmm.
and then they can grab that. They can basically go to a bank account or right. a bank site, try to log in with you. They get the text on their phone. Because they have your SIM now, and now your two-factor did you nothing.
Yeah. It's actually interesting where society is going in general. It's like right now I'm looking to do a home equity loan, and the company I'm dealing with, they won't allow attachments. I can't send them an attachment of anything. I'd have to mail it or fax it to them.
Wow.
Because rather than train the users to not click things,
sure.
right? They just said we just won't allow external attachments. Period. Which I think is actually kind of brilliant, because there are certain mistakes that you just can't do in the financial industry, and they're like, they just don't want to put that onus back on their users.
That's fair.
Don't make that mistake.
Facts will never die.
Huh?
Facts will never
right.
die.
Yeah, and this was interesting because it was like and this is one of your never seen that before things, right? to kind of dive into that a little bit. So how does malware actually work, right? So I actually saw this happen with a customer. the way we normally think of malware, at least I have in the past, was, okay, I got hit with a bug, it hangs around my machine for a while, and then it does something, and it's that one bug that I'm looking for. That's actually not how the complicated stuff does. So a PDF file comes in through email. The user opens the PDF, and it could be like invoice for toner cartridges or for light fixtures or something that was interesting, and it goes to somebody in accounting. They pay invoices, right? So they open it, open the PDF. Embedded in the PDF is a piece of malware. That infects the machine, but the malware is not harmful, mm-hmm. right? Instead, its purpose is to infect the machine, and then it will go download the real malware.
The real payload.
The real payload it's looking for.
That doesn't come via email, so it's not scanned.
Correct, right? So it doesn't come in through email. So it'll go out and download the second piece of malware, and it's also not technically malicious. Its job is discovery. So it's now going to spend as long of a time as it can. It's going to spread itself horizontally using SME protocols and other vulnerabilities through Windows and whatnot. And it'll start looking for, do some key logging. It'll look for any clear text passwords. It'll just starts collecting data and rating all that stuff home to tell the crooks what it's found and what they have. And they just let it sit there and fester for months, potentially, right? And when it finally reports back, hey, I was able to figure out the domain admin password. And I had, and I found out the local admin password that's the same on all the workstations. Then it tells the attackers that. Then they go, okay. Then that second piece of malware, they'll give it instructions to go download the ransomware. And the ransomware lives on your system for like a moment, right? It downloads it, and then boom, it hits it. It starts doing the encryption stuff. And the customer was left with a text file that said, hey, you've been hit with ransomware. Send an email to this address with further instructions on, how much to pay and what we're going to give you back in return.
Oof. It's pretty terrifying.
Very sophisticated stuff, and the thugs, they're good at it. They know what they're after, and they're making a lot of money at it.
Well, it makes you think back. You mentioned Michelangelo. That brings me back to when I first started getting into computers. And you see that on TV or the news, the nightly news, and you get all excited about it. It's thrilling and it's dangerous, but you think about it from this point of view, what was even the point back then to be destructive?
It was fame.
It was fame. That's
right.
It.
Yeah.
But now, I mean,
notoriety.
But now there's some cash attached to it, yeah. Significant dollars being siphoned out.
Right. Now it's a moneymaker for them.
Yeah. And this encryption is not, well, we'll just break the encryption. Not happening.
You're not breaking the encryption. Not without a key. So, so once you're infected with malware, you have two choices. Pay the ransom and hope they give you the key. Implement your disaster recovery plan and mm-hmm. restore from backup. And then in parallel to that, you also have to do a forensics discovery to find out where it came from. And you have to then change your security posture substantially because you have to find it. Because, when you restore up a backup, you must assume that you're also restoring the malware. It may not be the ransomware piece of malware. It may only be the first or the second malware that was there. But you've got to find it before it has a chance to launch or call home.
That's a really, really good point. I mean, restoring it, yeah, you think you're good. But you have to root that out or right. risk it just happening
right.
again.
And then the problem with the restoration is you're overriding all the logs that would have the information
sure.
that would help you find out where it was, mm-hmm. Where it may have come in. Right. So, one of the things with security holistically is there should be some form of common logging that's occurred from all the devices.
Central syslog server
yeah.
or something like that.
Right. To keep copies that off of, so the mail server sending its logs somewhere else, the domain controller sending its logs somewhere else.
Yep.
That way, when you have to restore those things, that log server you could put into a box and you'd have something to go back and start looking through to try and identify where the malware came
and
from.
And a lot of them are also common sense things that often come with the products you already have and may not be using. Something like storage level snapshots. They're immutable. If anything, you can take one of those snapshots, ship it off to another set of infrastructure, bring it up, investigate. Just things like that don't cost you any more money, but mm-hmm. it's a good idea to leverage the feature of the product that you have. For one.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, us at Ivoxy, Mac, we offer a security assessment, and mm-hmm. we currently are offering it for free to be willing to come in. What does that look like?
Yeah, through one of our distributors, they offer a free security assessment. The way it works is it's a hour and a half phone interview with whoever's the hands-on person with the IT infrastructure. And it's just a question and answer. It's not actually looking at any equipment. So it'll be like, what kind of firewall do you have? How long have you had it? What version of software is it running? You know, that kind of stuff. It's just a data collection point. And they target all the main areas. So it's not just network security. They're looking at, you know, endpoint security, server-side security, IPSs, URL filters, anti-malware, email filters, everything. And at the end of the questionnaire, then they take about a week and they'll write a report. And then we come back and share the report with you. And they compare what kind of business you are, how big you are, how small you are, because obviously larger enterprises, you know, have a lot more money and they're a lot bigger targets. Smaller companies obviously may be lesser, but nobody is immune. So in the security assessment, we take into account the type of business you are, the type of company you are, and the size you are. Because here and again, if we came out and said, hey, you need to buy everything here to be secure, and you look at all the products, you would go broke. Right. So it's a matter of where's the biggest bang for my buck? What should I start first? What should I do second? And help formulate, you know, like a 1 to 3 year plan going forward.
Get the low hanging fruit done right off the bat and then approach it from a more holistic standpoint. Yeah.
Because you'd ask earlier about, you know, like ASAs. I mean, if anybody's got an ASA 55, 10 or 20 lying around, that's first gen firewalls. You shouldn't be running those today. They're not next gen firewalls. You know, I see a lot of customers, you know, when I meet with them that don't have we'll call egress filtering, meaning they don't filter outbound traffic. So, and you say, well, I trust my users. I want them to go wherever they want on the internet. Well, that's great, but that also means if they're infected with malware, it can go anywhere that it wants to.
Yeah, like a layer 7 firewall, a next gen firewall, I should say, is going to suss out those command and control channels.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, when I was working at Cobalt in 2007 and 8, we did automotive digital marketing as an example, and the only car dealerships that we worked with were all United States car dealerships. And I'd look at my firewall logs, and I had an IPS at the time. It was a classic IPS. It was old, you know, obviously that was 2008 when I put that in. And I would, my logs were full with all these attacks from South Africa, you know, and Europe and stuff. And I'm like, we don't have any customers over there.
Right.
So I went in, and at that time I didn't have next-gen firewalls, so I was going through Aaron's IP address assignment list, and I went ahead and blocked the entire continent of Africa, Asia, Europe. I was like, if you took a vacation and went over there and tried to get to, you know, it would just say, you know, error 404,
can't
page
connect.
Not found.
Yep.
I just blocked it because I was like, there's no reason for them to even touch us. You know, coming over here today, you can go in the, you know, next gen firewalls, you can do geographic rules and say, these countries, I don't want to have access.
We're doing it right now. Another one of your colleagues, my colleague as well, Mr. Casolino and I, we share a half a rack downtown Seattle, and we use Meraki Kit in there to do some, basically our lab, essentially, right? I block Russia, I block South Africa, I block China, I block all the, you know, Asia Pacific countries, because the off chance that somebody out there needs to get in and I'm collaborating with them over, I'll know about it and I'll be like, hey, heads up, or we'll get you through. Outside of that, I'm okay with the occasional false positive.
Right.
For the it's not foolproof security, because they can certainly infect and hop to the US and then come over that way. Mm-hmm. But overall, it's all those scanners that just run willy-nilly out from that side, you're protected from all of that at that point. Yeah.
Regulatory, I know, also comes in this, you know, HIPAA, SOX, and PCI being the big three, HIPAA being healthcare, you know, protect the privacy, you know, patient privacy data, Sarbanes-Oxley, protect the financials, so the CFO is actually reporting to the to the stock market correctly on earnings and so forth, and obviously PCI being payment card industry. This is actually kind of a funny story. So I want to say it was probably 2008, I think it was, maybe 2009. I was at Cisco Live in Las Vegas. I was in a room with like 500 other engineers, really large room full, and we're talking about IPS and IDS. And for the folks that don't understand, an IPS and IDS is effectively the same thing. All that's different is how it interacts with the data. So for example, an IDS packet comes in from the internet, and a copy of that data is sent to the IDS, and another copy is sent directly to the server, which means if the first packet's malicious, the server is going to get hit with it. The IDS is going to see it. It's going to log it. And then the IDS can potentially block the communication, but the first packet is already hit. In an IPS, it's inline. So the IPS must do an evaluation, must say yay or nay to the packet before it ever goes in. So obviously IPS is more secure. In 2008, I'm sitting in a room, and the first question they asked was, how many people are running in IDS mode, or actually IPS mode? I was like one of two hands that went up. in that room.
Everyone's detecting but not doing anything
right.
about
it. And then they said, well, who's doing IDS? Everybody else is handling it. Right? And I was like, what am I doing wrong? Why am I so different? Well, what it turned out was is that back then, the data center engineers said to the security folks, stop, you're not putting this in my data center and affecting production traffic with false positives. We have SLAs with our customers.
False positive paranoia.
And the data center folks won because the business was more important than the false positives.
Than the inconvenience.
Right. Fast forward to the Target breach, the Primera breach, the everybody else, you know, breaches made the 5 o'clock news for the last many years. And the regulatory agencies, PCI and HIPAA stuff, they mandate.
We don't care.
They mandate IPSs now. Yep. The security guys went back to data center guys and said, no, you have to do this.
You work
now.
Around it.
It's totally flipped as far as the requirements and so forth now, just because it has gotten so bad out there. And I expect it to be the norm. Right?
Yeah, well, it's difficult. You've got your user base, your workforce. They're going to scream bloody murder because, hey, it's no longer easy to do my job. Now I have other hoops to jump through to get logged in. And yes, but the alternative is what we've been seeing happening over the last number of years.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Mac, thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate you coming down to Bothell, making the drive. And and we got a little home studio. Hope the sound good for everybody. We're always tinkering and trying to get the best sound quality for y'all. But obviously always looking to improve. Again, if you have questions about this, you can email us at podcast@ivoxy.com. You can visit us on our website at ivoxy.com and reach out via that email address or a form on the website if you have any questions or want to look into that free security assessment. I figure most of you are listening for that magic word free on the podcast, so hopefully your alarms went off. And if you want to have a talk about security and your security posture, you've got absolutely nothing to lose by reaching out and going through that that process. So hit us on Stitcher, Google Play Store, iTunes for the Ivoxy podcast. Visit us at ivoxy.com. And if you've got any questions, again, hit us at the aforementioned email. For Mac Nepkin, I am Matt Yeti. Thank you for listening to Data Center Therapy. Have a good day.